You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore, and Lois is not going to be able to say it's a bright, beautiful, sunny day here in Northern California.
Well, I could say it, but I don't lie, so I won't.
It got
hazy.
It's mostly cloudy, says the National Weather Service, and we have had extremely strange weather here for the last 4 or 5 days. Not that anybody is complaining about these temperatures. Lois and I are preparing this show on September 18th. 2024 for broadcast on September 19. And the temperature right now is 62 degrees, going up to a high today. Remember, September 18, going up to a high today of 73 degrees.
Hey, this is a first for the summer. This is the first time outside high is going to be lower than inside what we usually keep things at. And so we get to open up the house for the entire day.
Yes, many people left their windows open the last few nights, as we often do here in the summer. They woke up to rather cold mornings indoors. The low tonight is going to be 55 degrees. Thursday, we do have a warming trend, folks. It's been a very interesting and pleasant few days. Thursday will be 82 degrees and mostly sunny. Mostly clear Thursday night, 54 degrees. Friday, 83 degrees and sunny. Friday night, clear and 55 degrees. Saturday, 89. Sunday, 93. Monday, as I scroll down here, 94, Tuesday, 96, and the night temperatures Sunday and Monday will be 61 and 62, respectively. What's going on here? Well, we had some very interesting temperatures in the last 10 or so days. I was looking back at the CIMIS daily report. CIMIS gives you a daily report for a weather station near you somewhere. And back on September 6th, it was 103 degrees. On September 16th, it was 71 degrees. So
30 degrees difference in the high in 10 days.
Which I imagine happens in other parts of the country fairly regularly at this time of year, but it's quite unusual for us. You were just looking up the average high temperature for this day.
87, I think.
Yeah, and that was 71 day before yesterday. So we're way below average. I actually haven't had to water anything for a few days. And I can tell you, that's pretty much the first time this summer that that's been the case. Temperatures in the mid 80s and then the upper 70s. And then day before yesterday, the low 70s. But we're going back to more typical conditions. In fact, somewhat above average. Temperatures in the low to mid 90s will be occurring as we get into the weekend. The extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday, dry weather is expected through the extended forecast period. There were some showers here and there. In fact, I should mention, driving in the last three mornings, on two of them, I have seen farmers out spraying the tomato fields, presumably with fungicides, because they're going to be harvesting in a couple of days, and they were concerned about rainfall right before harvest, possibly leading to fruit rot or fruit, enough fruit mold that they would be perhaps rejected at the cannery. So they're out spraying before harvest because of the threat of rain in this area. Temperatures are going to warm up rapidly through the weekend into early next week with highs in the mid to upper 90s across the valley and delta. Areas of moderate heat risk will actually return to the region as temperatures are going to be 5 to 10 degrees above average. By the late weekend, the previous weather system will be located just south of the Great Basin, resulting in, by the way, do you know where the Great Basin is, Lois?
Utah.
Nevada, mostly. Yeah, all that area. Resulting in periods of light to breezy northerly flow across the more wind-prone areas of the Sacramento Valley, raising my hand. We're in one of those wind prone areas Sunday through Tuesday. So they're talking about north wind bringing in warmer temperatures. Daytime humidities will decrease gradually through this period into the upper teens to upper 20s, which may lead to localized fire weather conditions in the northern Sacramento Valley and adjacent foothills. Yeah, so we should have slightly cooler temperatures Wednesday, Thursday, and on, but mid-90s coming back next week. Everybody's been enjoying this strange weather. It's been feeling kind of fall-like, and we'll talk about the impact on your summer and fall vegetables as we get further into the program. I should mention that KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. So the California Raptor Center here at UC Davis is having their fall 2024 open house, Saturday, October 12th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. California Raptor Center and the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. It is being held at the California Raptor Center. You can stop by and meet the resident educational ambassador raptors and learn more about them and their wild kin. You can learn about what the Raptor Center does to rehabilitate and help local birds of prey, and including what you can do to help them. You can meet them on the glove. Their lectures will be held at 10 a.m. and noon. There will be free beer and wine samples donated by Super Owl Brewing at Nashoba Wines starting at noon. You must have an ID, obviously, for that. California Raptor Center having their big open house for the fall, Saturday, October 12th, 2024. Also, Tree Davis, I'd like to pass along this press release. We are looking for your help. We have Tree Stewardship Awards nominations. Every fall, Tree Davis honors some community members and organizations that help plant and care for trees and those who encourage education about the benefits of trees. Tree stewards is what we call you. You have helped to create the thriving canopy of trees in our parks, greenbelts, schools, and neighborhoods. Well, you can visit treedavis.org and submit the names of your favorite tree lovers. Past award recipients have included folks who help us water newly planted trees, people who encourage students to appreciate and plant trees, people who have achieved good shading of parking lots and public areas, and groups that help maintain gardens and wild areas around our community to the benefit of the local tree population. Anyone who you think has helped to sustain our urban forest. There is no limit to the number of nominees you can submit. Tree Davis will be accepting nominations until October 13, and recipients will be honored at the annual Legacy Celebration on November 2nd, held at the Legacy Grove in West Davis, and the public is invited to attend that event. So you can go to treedavis.org, and there's a link for where you can fill out a nomination form, and also email addresses that you can contact for more information about the Tree Stewardship Awards and all the other great programs that Tree Davis sponsors.
Okay. Well, Don, it is September, and let's talk about tomatoes.
Yeah.
So the question is, why did someone get poor tomato yields this summer?
Yeah, I've had some people coming in raving about their production. And in general, people have had really good results and are still getting really good results, but some didn't. So the first issue is,
well, most tomatoes won't self-pollinate if it gets above 90.
Yeah, that's a rule we talk about all the time. And of course, it's, you know, not an absolute thing that the 89 degrees are fine and 90 degrees they're not. Varieties do differ, and it depends on the type of the temperature, you know, how it happens, like one 30-minute period of the day, or is it all afternoon that's hot and so forth. But the varieties differ as to their sensitivity to high temperatures. And the first problem is that sometimes people are planting varieties that we know are not real successful here.
Because like Brandywine and Beefsteak and those other heirlooms that don't do well.
Yeah, many heirlooms don't set at high temperatures. They're not heirlooms from this region. They're heirlooms from, well, Brandywine is a good example. It's from the Brandywine Valley of Pennsylvania. I've been to Pennsylvania, and it was a little hot when we were there, you know, 85 degrees. It wasn't 100 degrees. So that's just not a good one for this area. And a lot of the other heirloom types have that same issue. So this is why I always suggest, you know, over and over in the spring and on radio programs, a mix of varieties. Even the one that's always done well for you, this might be the year when it doesn't. So planting, you know, six celebrity tomatoes, well, let's just do one celebrity and one early girl and one heirloom that you really want to try and so forth. So try some hybrids, try some cherry types, which are always reliable, along with your favorite heirlooms. This is the important data point. It's about 7 weeks, as we've told you before, learned this from a farmer, from fruit set to ripening for most types. So you can look at a fruit that's ripening and know roughly when that flower was pollinated, self-pollinated. This year, we had really good weather in May. So if you got your tomatoes in late April or early May or even into mid-May, all the way into mid-June, it was good weather for self-pollination of tomatoes. Most people got a very good early set. They were being harvested in early July. And then, as you'll recall, the month of July was very hot. Almost the whole thing. It wasn't like we were breaking records for the absolute temperature, but it was just day after day. Sacramento did have an extraordinary number of days in a row over 100 degrees. We were close to that, but Davis tends to run a little bit cooler, so we couldn't have bragging rights about how many exact days we got. But it was hot, and it was above average temperature throughout the entire month. And during July, I only had a couple of varieties that were really setting at all. So if you look at a lot of my vines, I have 6-foot tomato cages, and a lot of them set a whole bunch on the first 2 to 3 feet of growth. Then there was like 3 feet of growth with no fruit. And then by the time we got to the end of July, they were up and cascading out of the cages as usual. And then we had very good fruit set all through August, because August was cooler than average here for most of the month. We had our typical August cool down, and most of those are ripening now. I actually went out and did some counts to see which varieties are, you know, about to give me a whole lot of fruit mid-September and on into October. Personally, my heaviest yields are always in late September through October, partly because of the varieties that I choose, partly because I don't rush to plant them early, and I do give them good deep waterings through the summer. I was watering longer and more often this July than I normally have to do. So if you had followed your usual pattern, you know, of this is how I water, it wasn't enough this year in July, because every day for 3 weeks of July and pretty much the whole month was above average in water use. So that was a big part of why they might not have gotten good tomato yields, is simply one, the wrong variety, two, the plants were drought stressed as they went through July.
And Don keeps track of what he plants and how well it does. And as he says, he doesn't recommend tomatoes until they've been through his testing for a couple of years and done well. So I would recommend to listeners, instead of going with charts you find online, go and ask Don what does well here. I mean, assuming you're in our area. Yeah. If you're someplace else, ask locally. But Don's list is much better curated, I guess, or what would you say? He does the work to make sure it's going to really work here.
Yeah, I've had years where I'll take a variety I've never grown before, and it just is fantastically. And I'm going, all right, we can really recommend this. Right? I've gotten burned on that. Let me tell you, folks, I've done, and one I like to cite as an example is Brandy Boy, because the first year I grew it, it's a cross between Brandywine and probably Better Boy or something like that. And the first year I grew it, it set early. I got it in early. It set early, and it 31-pound fruit. Unbelievable, beautiful fruit, great flavor. I thought, all right, this is one I can really recommend.
It was a cool summer, though.
It was and I should note, I made a note of this later, it was early set on that one. So we had a good start to the season on that one. I got very good set. The next year, which was a fairly hot summer, I got zero. Every year I get at least one tomato that does this to me. Zero fruit on a perfectly healthy, robust vine. And this is why. Now I'll tell people Brandy Boy can be fun. It can be a great tomato. Don't plant a bunch of them because, you know, it might not do real well. And I have a couple others that are in that category. Well, this year, some varieties have been very consistent year to year. And the new hybrids that I've touted repeatedly now, Bodacious and Rugby, outstanding. Both the early fruit production and this late season fruit production has been very good. Lemon Boy this year produced very, very well. If you like a yellow tomato, it's got a firmer skin, so it holds up well. And I've had probably 80 fruit on that plant. All of the Chef's Choice varieties, very impressive. And they've all proven very well for me year after year. And this is one comment I always make, especially to new gardeners. Cherry tomatoes will yield under almost any conditions. If someone walks in and they have more shade than is optimal for tomatoes, well, you know, a cherry tomato will grow and produce in partial shade. So if you're a new gardener, you haven't quite figured out your soil, you're watering, not only will they set well, they ripen faster. They don't take 7 weeks to ripen, and they'll produce under most conditions. So cherry tomatoes are a good one to have out there if you happen to like them. Early Girl, I got to say this, is great and very popular, but New Girl, year after year now, 3 or 4 years running, is outperforming Early Girl, and they are seemingly identical. So I'll give you a follow report on those a little bit later, but New Girl is definitely producing more. produced a little further into the heat, has a larger late crop, and the flavor is the same, and the fruit is very similar, and the plants are very similar. So it looks like that's a good, worthy competitor to Early Girl that's outperforming it. Something to watch for. You may have to grow it yourself from seed if your local nursery isn't growing it, but it's definitely worth looking for. But the main reason someone didn't get good yields is probably inadequate depth of watering during July, because they were needing more water. That site that I mentioned for the temperatures, the CIMIS weather stations, CIMIS, give you the daily ET rate, the evapotranspiration rate. And if you look back at the month of July, for the first 3 weeks of July, it was anywhere from 10 to 20% above average evapotranspiration rate every day, day after day. Discussing this with people who've lived here for a long time, the usual pattern in the past has been 3 or 4 days really hot. You get a north wind, you get 2 or 3 days that are very hot. The next day is dropping down to more normal temperatures. And then the Delta breeze comes flushing in and we get cooler days for 2 or 3 days. We go back and forth. What we had was about 3 weeks straight where it just didn't break. It wasn't, 115, but it was 102, 103, which is higher than is optimal for these plants. And the ET rate was higher on all of those days. So the ET rate overall for the first 3 weeks of July was anywhere from 10 to 15% above average. If you were watering like you normally did, it wasn't enough. First July, I've ever watered my tomato plants every day. I normally go 2 to 3 days between waterings, but I was watching their performance and watering every day. And if you have a raised bed, I don't know how many times we talk about this, they dry out faster. So your margin of error on that watering was lower than mine, where they're just out in the field. So if you have a raised bed and you were watering what seemed to be normal, it wasn't enough this year. And of course, most people don't water enough to begin with. Bear that in mind for next year as you adjust your drip irrigation system, maybe running another line through the bed, maybe it's certainly running it longer. That is the most likely reason here in the Sacramento Valley that people wouldn't have gotten good yields this year.
So I just want to give the list really quickly. He has a list of varieties and mm-hmm. top farmers to date, and then all these little notes. And there's the 3X ones, the 2X, the 1X, and
yeah.
Okay, so the 3X ones, I'm just going to read you this list. So if you don't get anything else, come back here and just get this list. Bodacious.
Yep.
Chef Choice Orange. Lemon Boy. New Girl. Principi Borghese. I love saying that one. Rugby. And those are the ones that have the 3Xs. And we'll talk about the rest later.
Yeah, but that right there would be an interesting mix because you've got the hybrid, you've got some heirloom, you've got a determinate one that's used mainly for processing, that Principa Borghese, which is a small fruited, but it's used for sun drying, but also makes great salsas and sauces. So you could actually, and then the Chef's Choice series, which are, that's a bright orange one, and the Lemon Boy is yellow. So with that, what was it, 6, I think you just read? That'd be a good mix. You'd have that portfolio we're always talking about. You'd have an heirloom, you'd have hybrid, you'd have coupled for colorful fruit and so forth. So
is there a cherry tomato in there?
Well, actually, Principa Borghese is small enough that you can use it like a cherry tomato. It's just very meaty. Most cherry tomatoes are rather juicy. It's more like a sauce tomato, but it is cherry tomato size. And as for cherry tomatoes, I actually have 4 different varieties in the ground this year, and each one of them has 200 or 300 fruit on it. I mean, the cherry tomatoes, but they all did very well, just set ridiculous quantities. And also I've had questions about that purple tomato, the GMO. I think we talked about that in the previous show. It has right now over 100 fruit on it. I mean, it's just a phenomenal producer. The flavor is mild. Most of us have concluded that they've got a good producer, they've got an interesting, colorful tomato, but it's not setting off any alarms in terms of great flavor. It's unfortunate. It's just sort of an insipid flavor, but good yields, I got to say, on that one, if you're interested in that particular genetic modified tomato that's being called the purple tomato, because it's got purple flesh.
Okay. Well, enough of that. That's the notes that he made about the tomatoes. And now let's ask you, Don, about the count. I know that things aren't done. We're still only in the middle of September. But how's your count going on these tomatoes?
Yeah, this is...
He gave me a list.
Yeah, the question comes up, I had a really good year or the comment will be made and I'll say, oh, really? How many are you getting? Oh, 10. I'm thinking, well, that's not a really good year. I'm concerned. You should be able to get about 20 pounds of tomato off an indeterminate tomato vine here in the Sacramento Valley without much effort. That's what it should produce planted deep in reasonably good soil, maybe some source of nitrogen at the beginning of the season, and watered deeply and correctly, you should get about 20 pounds. You can get 30 to 40 pounds of fruit off of some varieties. And of course, you can push them if you want to do that with more careful applications of nitrogen. But what does 20 pounds mean? Well, if they're 1 pound fruit, which is big, that's 20 fruit. More typical is 6 to 8 ounce fruit. So you should be getting 30 or 40 off of something like that. Cherry tomatoes are only 1 to 2 ounces. So 20 pounds is, you know, 100, 200 or more. Those are the kind of yields you should be able to get here without too much difficulty. Yes, we all know fervent tomato growers who have their special method and who feed them with this, that, or the other, and they get way more than that. But that's what the average person should be able to get. If you're only getting 5 or 6 tomatoes on a plant, you probably chose a variety that is going to struggle with our heat, or you didn't water it deeply enough. But I'm going out there and counting what I got from what we call in the Sacramento Valley the August cool down. I have to credit Mark Finan, local meteorologist, TV weather personality, who would use that term. We're having our August cool down. And it is very typical here. Every year I've been here, practically, I can't think of any exceptions to this. June comes along, you have a couple really hot days. July, you know, that's when we're going to have a real heat wave typically. And then the pattern shifts and we start getting influence monsoon air pushing up from the Gulf and so forth. And we even have those funny little days where there's overcast and where they're getting rain in Southern California, which has happened plenty of times this summer. And we do have several days every August where it's below average, where the temperatures are in the 80s or even just barely breaking 90. Well, this year, August, we had almost 3 weeks of that, and it's been great. Everybody's been happy about it. They're getting good fruit set, and it's happening again now. There's people listening in different parts of the country. So here's the reason I wanted to bring this up. Right now, I have a whole lot of fruit out there on some varieties. These fruit counts on, for example, Costoluto Genovese, I just counted more than 50 fruit on that plant. And it had given me almost none yet. So it didn't like the early part of the season. Huge crop coming now, more than 50. And these are roughly 8 ounce fruit. And they're just beginning to turn from green, not to red, but just from green. There's a phrase they use in the tomato industry called breaker stage. And the field workers who are picking for the fresh tomato market especially know that if you can pick it at breaker stage, it will ripen over the next 5 to 6 days, which is how long it takes to get to the grocery store, for example. If you can pick something at breaker stage, you can bring it in to your counter and it will ripen on the counter. So it's the middle of September. If you're listening in one of those places where it's rapidly getting colder, then you can go out there and make some evaluations of the fruit that's set perhaps over the last couple of weeks. A few weeks, 4 or 5 weeks ago is what would have been necessary to be arriving at this ripening stage. If they're just off of green, not still green, but off green to lighter, that's breaker stage, that will ripen. Tomatoes are climacteric fruit. They will ripen after being picked. They'll get sweeter. They'll get just as much flavor as if you vine, almost as much flavor as if you vine ripened them. So they're still good to set on the counter or do whatever it is you do. Make it so they're not touching, because if one of them spoils, that spoilage will spread rapidly to the one next to it. But just set them out on the counter or in a box of something, newspaper or whatever, and they will ripen over 5 to 7 days, depending on the temperature. Don't put them in the refrigerator. You never put a tomato in the refrigerator. Just let them ripen on your counter or in some place at 60 to 80 degrees, roughly. If they're green, still green, then you better look up green tomato recipes. But here, we still have time for them to ripen, because we're about to get back into the 90s. Our temperatures in October are well within the ripening range. We can get plants, fruit ripening on the vine or on the counter all the way through mid to late October. And almost anybody who has gardened here has had the experience of having some varieties still ripening fine out on the vine, even into November. What starts to happen, and it's happened a little bit with the colder temperatures we've had this week and the little bit of rain some people got, spoilage of the fruit on the vine starts to happen pretty rapidly. So sometimes they're spoiling just as they're ripening. That's something to watch for. If a bird has come in or a leaf-footed bug and poked something through the skin, that's an opening to the rot organisms, the bacteria and stuff that get in and spoil the fruit. And it doesn't take much of an opening to start that process. So as I'm out picking right now, this one will be fine. The one right next to it that got injured a little bit, part of the plant, part of the fruit is already spoiling. I do suggest picking those off and throwing them in the compost or whatever, but be aware of that as you bring them in, that some of them may have had their skin injured or broken by weather, or more commonly by vertebrate pests of one sort or another, or insect pests of one sort or another, and they will start to spoil very rapidly. And if you're in a place where night temperatures are dropping below 55, you will start seeing spoilage progressing faster than ripening. If it's below 50, you'll definitely start seeing that. You're getting down into the mid to low 40s, they're definitely going to spoil, and they aren't going to be ripening as quickly or properly out there as they would indoors. So if you're listening in a place where it's feeling more like fall and you're going to continue in that pattern, you should probably pick them, bring them in, ripen them on the counter, or if they're rock hard green, you start looking up green tomato recipes. Here, we've got a full more 6 weeks more of potential ripening weather. But do be aware that any passing rainstorm can get in there, especially if your plants are very crowded and dense, and spoilage can start to occur. So monitor for that. But we still have plenty of time for them to ripen. And I've got some numbers out there that from that August cool down, Michael Pollan is one of the wild boar farms that has more than 50 fruit that are just getting ready to ripen. Costoluto Genovese, I mentioned 50. Rugby, which has already given me 3 or 4 dozen fruit on this plant, has 50 more on the plant, and they're already turning color. Bodacious, 35 more fruit as of this morning. Chef's Choice Orange, 35 more fruit as of this morning. Cherokee Purple, more than 35 fruit. So there's a bunch of them that have, you know, 2-3 dozen fruit ready to ripen either on the vine or indoors. That's something we can count on here in the Sacramento Valley and in the interior parts of Southern California, because we're dry. That's the main thing. Even if it's not as warm as we would like, we don't typically have rainfall or enough rainfall to really worry about. Whereas in other parts of the country, I know you're moving rapidly into fall. I do want to mention the one that Lois and I have talked about a couple times. Principa Borghesa is a determinate tomato. So you can plant that one in April or May. And we harvested 100 fruit off of it in early July. And normally people look at a determinate tomato and they say, well, it's done. Take it out. Okay, fine. You can do that. And actually, that's a great way to go if you want to conserve water. And if you're mainly into processing, you get these big harvest off of it. You're done by mid-July. It's getting hot. Just cut it down. We'll put, you know, prep that area for your fall crops and be ready to go. But I will tell you that determinate tomatoes don't just fruit all at once and stop. They mostly do, but not completely. So I left it in after we harvested 100 fruit from it, and there's another 50 on there that are ripening now. The plant is only 3 feet tall. This is an outstanding variety for those of you that like a nice, rich flavored, firm tomato and don't have a lot of space. It will produce a heavy crop all at once, but if you leave it in, you will still get some fruit for salads and things like that. So you don't have to rush to take out determinate types. It's just that they mostly do their crop all at once. This one does continue, and I will tell you, I've grown this one in a container, and it's done reasonably well in a 15-gallon container. And even 1 year, I grew it in partial shade just to see what would happen. The plant grew to about 5 to 6 feet, stretched out a bit more, still produced about 60 or 70 fruit. So if you're limited for space and you want a sauce type tomato or a really rich flavored cherry style tomato, it's one to look for. And if you want to do this kind of new strategy that some people are using where they grow for an early crop as much as possible and then just get the tomatoes out of their garden before the super heat comes on and they're having to water all the time in July and August, it would be a very good candidate for that as well. Determinate types would allow you to conserve water and still get a good crop, at least for processing. So I have more and more people who are doing tomatoes heavily, plant a lot early in the season, get a big crop, take most of them out, leave like one cherry tomato and one salad tomato and let them continue through the summer. But they do their processing early, and then they try to reduce their water use. And that's one way to go, is to look for some of these exceptional determinate types. And I think Principa Borghesa would be a good one for considering for that.
Well, that was a lot of tomato talk.
Hey, we can talk about tomatoes endlessly. But let's move on to something else.
Let's move on. So Caitlin writes to us from Walnut Creek about pruning citrus trees. Now, Caitlin is a listener who frequently writes. Mm-hmm. So she says, hi, Don and Lois. How and when do I prune citrus trees? I have a mature navel orange that I want to keep to about 6 to 7 feet so that I can reach the fruit and maintain my view. It has also had fruit or flowers on it all the time. By the time I'm done harvesting the crop, the flower buds for next year are already starting to open. How do I keep the size controlled without sacrificing too much of the fruit? Is it current It is currently only a bit bigger than I'd like, at about 8 feet.
Yeah, navel orange would be a challenge. Well, not a challenge, but it wants to get 15 feet on almost any rootstock you're buying them on, 15 or 20 feet. So this is going to be fairly hard pruning. The only time I don't prune citrus is when we're going into freezing weather. I prefer not to prune when it's about to be 115 degrees. So I don't generally prune during a heat wave or in extreme heat. So middle of the summer is not generally optimal. So I've generally done pruning on them. I prune them when they're in bloom. That doesn't really worry me all that much. It'll reduce your yield somewhat, but there's always way more flowers than there can be fruit. So don't worry too much about that. So you can do your size control pruning anytime you're not about to leave open pruning wounds that could be injured by cold weather. And by cold weather, I mean freezing weather. You could prune now. September is fine. I typically do mine March, April. Yep, they're blooming often when I do that, but that's okay. It still gives plenty of yield. So I would just be more concerned about injury to the tree. And the likeliest time of injury to the tree from pruning would be when you're in freezing weather, where you've opened them up to, you know, pruning cuts that could be harmed by temperatures, let's say 29, 30 degrees. Or July, August, if you see a heat wave coming and you prune an evergreen plant right before that heat wave, the leaves that you're now exposing to sunlight were in the shade before, and you're almost sure to get sunburn on them. So my preference in terms of optimal, least stress to the plant would be to prune it in the spring or the fall. And in the fall, I prefer to do it earlier than later. So I would say now is a very good time to go out and prune it. Generally speaking, navel oranges set in when the tree should bloom in April. March, April, and set, and that's your main bloom period on it. So that's what you're really concerned about. The fruit then sets and ripens, and you pick it the following January, February. Yes, they can hang on there into late spring or summer, and they're okay, but the best flavor is January, February, March. By April, navel oranges are generally getting a little bit insipid. So if you want to work around the harvest and the bloom, the same thing applies. Fall pruning should be fine. March, April pruning should be fine because you should be pretty well done with your harvest by then on most typical navel oranges.
Is there some, I thought it was a navel orange, but maybe it's a different kind of orange. Is there some kind of orange where the cycle from blossom to ripe is more than a year? Because yeah. I thought for sure I had some where there was blossoms on it with green fruit.
Their Valencia oranges ripen in the summer. So Valencia oranges, which were originally a pretty big industry in California, but they don't color up real well here. The flavor can be great, but they turn orange and then they turn back to partially green. When I was a kid, they used to dye oranges orange. because that's illegal now, but they used to dye them orange because Valencia oranges were grown heavily in California, and they were great because they could harvest them early and they'd be tangier and later and they'd be sweeter. And to me, it's a fairly mild flavored citrus. It's not really one of the best, but they had a long harvest season, but the consumers wouldn't buy them because they were greenish orange. They weren't bright orange, so they would dye them. They don't do that, and Valencia oranges are hardly grown in California anymore. It's the juice orange. It's the mainstay of the Florida orange juice industry. Navel oranges, typically most varieties, ripen best good in January, really good in February. That's really when they're at their peak, January to mid-February, and they hang on the tree okay into March. There are navel orange varieties, such as one called Summer Navel, which hang on and keep their color and flavor well into the summer. I've tasted it. It's not as flavorful later in the season as a Washington navel picked at its peak of perfection, but it's an option for those of you who want summer citrus. There are some other kinds of citrus. If you're in the Bay Area, Trovita is a popular sweet orange. It doesn't have a really visible navel, but it follows the same pattern. But you can harvest those well into March, April, even into May, and they've got very good flavor. It's a very sweet variety. It's a good one for coastal residents and people in the San Francisco Bay Area, and probably really good in Southern California. So if your citrus haven't had the depth of flavor you're after, you might look into Trovita. So there are some that ripen at different times. But in terms of the common navel orange, Washington or Robertson varieties of navel orange, they typically are kind of done by March. Yeah, I walk by my citrus trees and there's a fruit hanging on there, and I'll always sample them out of season. And generally what happens is they get sweeter and milder. So they're okay. I just picked a mandarin on one of my Tango mandarin trees a week or so ago. That was one I should have picked in March. And okay, but it was hanging on there. It still had good color. I picked it. I peeled it. It was just all sweet. Texture was okay. It just didn't have the depth of flavor because all the acidity was gone. And so some people would probably be fine with that. I mean, I'm I started a mandarin orchard here, and I made sure to get a couple in there that are predominantly sweet for that particular taste flavor profile that some people prefer. Picking late is okay, but your peak season is done by the time they start blooming again. So I have frequently pruned my navel orange for size control because mine is about 15 feet tall. In April, when it's blooming, just kind of brush the bees aside as I go in to prune it. I very commonly would prune it, and I'm thinking of doing it right now, in mid-September to early October, well ahead of any freeze danger here in Northern California.
Okay. Caitlin has a couple more questions. She says, I've attached a picture of the old-fashioned flowers which you suggested for along the big, blank, west-facing wall of my house. I tried all of your suggestions to see what would work.
Oh, cool.
I could report great success with a Benary giant zinnia,
yeah,
coral fountains amaranth, and sunflowers. But the hollyhocks are much too tasty for the deer. They nip off every single bud, so I haven't seen a single flower this year.
Yeah.
So next year, I won't plant hollyhocks. Next year, I'll improve the arrangement to get a bit more height in the center, but it's always already a great improvement from before. And the picture is lovely.
Yeah,
and
this is great.
What she means about the zinnias are spectacular, and there's some interesting sunflowers there.
Those are flowering sunflowers that branch. I grow all kinds of sunflowers. Some of them are one and done. You know, these are for the cut the flower industry or the ones you grow for seed. Typically you grow a big plant, grows up, gives one big bloom, and that's it. There's a bunch of them that branch and that have smaller flowers but greater profusion. I really like those. And they do set seeds, by the way. So in my property, because it's a farm and you know I'm not having a public display garden, I just let them go. I have a whole bunch of sunflowers. We've talked about my thing of planting a bunch of seeds in one spot. And now those are all past their peak, but they're all setting seed. There's some that I grew to harvest, the Mongolian giant, and some that I'm just going to let seed right out there in the garden and let the songbirds enjoy them. So if you happen to leave those, yeah, I know it can look a little shaggy as you go into the winter, but you will find little songbirds, including probably white-crowned sparrows, will sit there on top of those old dead or dying sunflower plants and poke around in there and eat the little seeds that they provided and the handful of bugs that are on there. So they're great for wildlife. So if you don't mind the appearance, go ahead and leave them. They are more showy than the one and done types because you just get more bloom per plant. And then the hanging blossoms on this are that fascinating amaranth. It's one of my favorites for this purpose. They have these really showy, interesting blooms. There's a bunch of different kinds. And the Benary giant zinnia, I can't heap enough praise on that one. It's a great big plant. Big bloom. Blooms last and last. If you cut it as a cut flower, it goes for 7 to 10 days in a vase, just opening out and becoming even more elegant. So great picture, and I'm glad it worked for you. West exposure can be a challenge, and these are some of the plants that can really take that. As for deer, I am just very thankful that I don't deal with deer in my garden. There's a lot of wildlife that I'm fine with. That would probably infuriate me to walk out and see all your roses eaten off or your hollyhocks, but at least maybe you should plant hollyhocks on one end of the garden, no place else to draw the deer down there. Use it as a trap crop.
Actually, that wouldn't do any good. It would just bring the deer into your yard, and then when they finished off that, they look around for something else. Now, not to have anything that makes them stop there, because they bounce all over the place.
Yeah, comments I've had from people about managing deer is that when they're hungry enough, they'll eat anything.
So. That's true. What I want to say about the picture is I love the shadows that those sunflowers are casting on the wall. They're tall enough that it actually is making a shadow on the wall. The short little things, the amaranth, it isn't doing much for me, but the zinnias and the sunflowers, I just love that. They're just so pretty.
If I were adding something to this, the one that really impressed me in the full sun part of my vegetable garden, because I often just have a stray emitter where I'll stick a flower just to see how it is, the celosias. Celosia has three different variants. Coxcomb is the one most people know, the crested form that are fascinating flowers, contorted. My kids used to call them brain flowers, and they dry beautifully. The plume forms are actually much more attractive garden plants because they continue to put lateral shoots out and make a very attractive plant. And there's one that's called spicata. Celosia spicata, which you'll see in the florist trade a little bit. It's a plume looking with a narrower spike, hence the name spicata. That one's got me a little worried because I planted it last year in one spot, and now I have about an 8-foot row of it that has reseeded itself. So that one, I'm going to keep an eye on it in terms of spreading more vigorously than I like, but it's taken the heat real well. So look at some of the plume flowers or coxcombs or some of these celosias to add to your mix next year. And really, it looks like all that's been going on here, a drip line. And the way I do this is a drip line goes and I put an emitter in and the plant goes right where the emitter is. And it's the simplest way to organize your garden that you can come up with. That way you know that that plant is getting water and you just run it with the vegetables, basically. Same kind of watering pattern as your vegetable garden. These are all plants that could take more drought than that if it comes to it. But it looks like a lovely border and this is a great way to go for a hot exposure. West exposures can be very challenging here in the interior.
So this is all annuals, right?
Yeah, these are all
annuals. Okay, so if you wanted to add something that was a little bit taller, but was a perennial, but bloomed in the winter, what about Euryops?
Sure, or if you want to stay focused on annuals. Now let's back up here, since I went to a seminar years ago when we first went into retail, and the guy leading it, who was a consultant, said, "All right, what is the jargon that you all use that the public understands the least?" And people started rattling off all these long terms like this, that, or the other. He said, "No, annual and perennial. Most people get them backwards. Most people don't know what they mean." And over time, I've come to realize that's partly because they aren't that clear cut. So, So you mentioned these are all annuals, and I said, "Yes, but you know what? Hollyhocks are biennials. You plant hollyhocks now for bloom next year." Having said that, there are annual foxglove varieties on the market. Did I say foxgloves? I meant hollyhocks. Yeah, foxgloves are also biennials, but there's also an annual hollyhock and an annual foxglove on the market. Snapdragons would be what I would add to this for the winter time, and this is the time to plant them. I've been having lots of fun with old-fashioned kinds of snapdragons. I sell snapdragons. I'm a retailer. All I can get for you are typically... And these are cool. The very dwarf ones that grow to a foot and bloom like crazy. The ones that are 18 inches, which are really outstanding garden plants. Those are the sonnets and some of the others. And they're nice and tight, so they make really good bedding plants. But the taller ones are harder to get a hold of. Look in your local garden center for rocket variety snapdragon. You plant it now, it'll grow up a little plant, flush out from the base. The first part will give you one bloom, one spike of blooms. It's not done by any means. That first spike will bloom in, let's say, November, and it'll hold right through the winter. So they're very impervious to cold and rain here in the USDA Zone 9. And then those ones that have flushed from the base will expand as we get into late January and February, and you'll get a whole shrub-like thing of snapdragons that'll get up to 2 to 3 feet in the case of Rocket, and every one of them will bloom. Every one of those shoots will come up and bloom. So you'll have spectacular snapdragons in late March, April and May, and even into June. Rocket is probably the tallest snapdragon you're going to find at any garden center. But if you are thinking of starting things from seed right now, look for the UC introductions or some of the other snapdragon varieties that were bred years ago when snapdragons were more popular. And there are varieties that will get to 3 to 4 feet in bloom, be spectacular plants. And while I say they're annual, I have a 4-year-old snapdragon in my backyard that looks like a shrub. I didn't pull it out. It looked rough in the summer. It's in a place where it gets watered with everything else, so sort of automatically. It doesn't look great in the summer, but it's not bad, so bad that you really want to take it out necessarily, but it's not blooming in the summer. But I let it go through, and it comes back into bloom in the fall and winter and blooms heavily the following spring. So it's going into its fourth year now. So they can function as perennials, as many of the things we call annuals can. Snapdragon is what I would probably put in there now, but of course you can also plant pansies and violas and calendulas and other things. Most of them are shorter, so I was trying to think of things that are a little bit taller. Stock is the other thing. If you like stock, if you love that fragrance, get them planted in September and you'll get the best results. It's okay in October and November, but really good results when you get them in earlier. That same thing is with the snapdragon. The basal shoots will come out and give you 5 times as much bloom as the plant that you put in 6 weeks from now.
The other way to go to get a little taller something in there is to put a trellis with stakes that go into the ground, and the trellis is attached to the stakes, and then in the spring plant something that's going to climb up it and look pretty. Now,
Why wait till spring? Plant sweet peas right now.
Well, yeah, but then they would preclude your planting anything for the summer, wouldn't they? Sweet peas wouldn't be done.
We'll talk about that in the summer.
Well, okay. But anyway, when I had a rental house and we had a west exposure on the house, it got so hot. So what we did is we put up a trellis. Well, in our case, we used netting, but that's okay. Trellis would work. And we did scarlet runner beans. The leaves shaded the house and the beautiful flowers were there. And then there were long beans that were edible. I mean, they weren't great, but they were edible. But
Mark your calendar to do that in May or June or even July, because you can plant them that late. Just after you take out your sweet peas. So get this ready. Get this ready. And this is actually interesting. The timing of peas and sweet peas is the same. It's garden peas or sweet peas. This is the perfect time to start the seed right now, mid-September, because you'll get the plants up. Cover them for the white-crowned sparrows. Maybe I'll just say that once right now so I don't have to repeat it 100 times. I completely failed with peas a couple of years ago. I planted them 4 times and the white-crowned sparrows got every one of them. So part of that was I was planting later. I was planting in October. But that's not the main issue. Get the seeds in the ground or pre-start them in pots. They do tend to rot easily if you direct seed in the ground. So a lot of people do get their best results starting the seed in small containers that you can then put out in the ground as soon as they come up. But try them in the ground if you're careful about your watering. Sweet peas are an old-fashioned flower. Most people don't even know what they are anymore. This is the interesting part. They're a cool season annual, and they truly are. They grow rapidly in the fall. They stop when we get into the coldest weather in December and January. And then as soon as the days are getting longer, they just rush to the top of a 4-foot or 6-foot trellis, depending on the variety. There are some that are good for containers as well. There are some dwarf ones. And then they give those amazing flowers that are powerfully fragrant. I have learned, just like with paper white narcissus, some people don't like the fragrance of sweet peas. So you may enjoy them only out in the garden if you have a household member who doesn't like their smell. Some of them are way more fragrant than others. And there's lots and lots of varieties. But it's one of these old-fashioned flowers that people kind of stopped growing. They don't like extreme heat. So here they're done by May. And at that point, they're setting pods, which are going to snap open, scatter themselves. And typically when you plant sweet peas, you'll have them for years, but they're generally done by, we hit the upper 80s, you know, about the time we're planting tomatoes, the sweet peas are done. Time to pull them out. Guess what? You can plant scarlet runner bean on that trellis at that point. Or you could do morning glory if you're, you know, so inclined. There are summer vines that are grown that are annuals that you can grow from seed. But in the winter, we do have this one, which is sweet peas, and they do need full winter sun. This is really important. The more shade they're in, the more mildew they'll get. That was kind of the big issue with sweet peas, and I think partly is why they fell out of favor, was the susceptibility to powdery mildew. But if they're in full sun, good air circulation, you really don't have to do anything. Once you've gotten them watered and the seeds are up and they're established and we get into the rainy season, they're on their own at that point. Very, very easy to grow. The only problem I've had with them literally is the white-crowned sparrows are very, very attracted to seedlings of peas, both sweet peas and regular garden peas. And it's important to know sweet peas are toxic, regular peas are not. So don't put them in the same part of your garden. Put the sweet peas in the flower garden and the other shelling and snap peas over in the vegetable garden.
So when you say that the white-crowned sparrows like the seedlings, how far up, if they got to be 2 inches tall, would that be safe then?
No, apparently not. So it seems six inches and beginning to take off seemed to be what it took. So covering over the young seedlings is pretty important if you have a problem with white crown.
You know, if you have a trellis, covering them is really easy.
Yes, indeed.
Just wrap the thing around the trellis at the, you know, at the 1 foot level and staple the netting to itself and there it is. And you can keep that on for a while too.
Maybe I should try that.
You should. Well, but you don't have a trellis to put them on.
Yeah.
You're not putting them on a trellis, are you?
I'm going to put them on a short trellis. Yes, just for the record, sweet peas need some kind of a structure or else they'll just run across the ground. Now, there are a couple of varieties, Baijiu and Nihai and others that are compact growers that you can do in containers. I've done them and they're really cool. They cascade over the side and they bloom at about 3 feet. So
my question, if you're going from seed into little pots, I don't really want to try and transplant from a little pot into the ground.
They're very breakable. They're very fragile.
And you use those little tiny peat pots, and then you plant the whole thing pot and all, and the pot disintegrates as the plant grows. Does that work?
Yes, peat pots and peat pellets, and they make some out of coir now that you can purchase as well, where you just plant right into that. The other is to just plant them in the ground, water once, don't water again until they sprout. And that's something I learned years and years ago from a longtime advisor to the master gardeners here in Yellow County with peas and beans. We get more complaints about them just rotting after planting. And in part, that's because any of us who plant seeds go out and we water daily. You know, we think these are seeds. They need daily attention. They will rot if that if you do that with peas and beans, not fava beans. Don't worry about them, but green beans in the summer, peas and sweet peas in the fall and winter. So you plant them, you water once. You don't water again. It's really hard not to water. You don't water again until they push up out of the ground. And if that, once they're up, you just water them normally, but they rot if you overwater them when you plant the seed. And that's counterintuitive for most people. The other is, as we get further into the season, you can still plant peas and sweet peas all the way into November. But as we get colder at night, that germination would take longer. The incidence of rot seems to be higher. The damage from snails and slugs and sparrows and such increases just because the plants are growing more slowly. So pre-germinate them in that situation. If you're planting 4 or 5 weeks from now, take the seed, peas or sweet peas, put them on damp paper towels in a casserole dish, cover them with more damp paper towels, pull it back each day to check. It's only going to be about 3 days before they start to sprout. Then carefully take those sprouting seeds and go ahead and plant them out in the garden. But I do think those peat pellets and peat pots are a way easier way for most people to go. Nurseries do sell peas and sweet peas in six packs, but they're really fragile. They just, so many people have had the experience of them just breaking apart as you're trying to plant them. Definitely, if your kids are working on this, it should be supervised. Perhaps little fingers will be better at it than our big clumsy fingers, but they need to watch because they're just very breakable. And if they're really overgrown in the six pack, you kind of have a problem. I've taken overgrown six packs of peas and sweet peas because I don't want to sell them. And I'll tell you what I do. I pop them individually as one mass out of those six packs. So I have one mass of foliage in my left hand, holding very carefully, and six clumps of root in my right hand, and I plant that whole thing in one place. I did this years ago to see what would happen. You know what? It works like a charm. So it's better than trying to tease them apart unless you're really good at that. Just be aware that seedlings of peas and sweet peas are fragile.
All right. And so the last thing before we end is a horrible photograph that Don sent me. It's called fig fly.
Yeah.
And someone wrote they just bought a large panache tree.
I've heard it pronounced panache and panache. It's a striped, whatever. Tiger stripe is the other name you see on that tree variety.
I just bought a large tree in Sacramento, completely infested with black fig fly. I saw the live flies, and nearly all the fruit has signs of it. The tree is going back, obviously, and we notified the management at that store that the black fig fly wasn't known in Sacramento. I thought I would let others know.
Yeah, this
and
is important.
And there's another large five trees they have there, and at least 10 other large fig trees with fruit, all likely infested, judging by this tree.
Yeah, black fig fly is a fig pest that works much like the spotted wing Drosophila on cherries. Unfortunately, this little fly oviposits on green, unripe fruit, which is what the cherry fly does. It oviposits on fruit that is just starting to ripen in, as well. And then the larva tunnels into the fruit and you cut into your fig and it's full of these wriggling worms. Although in the case of figs, you might have more usable fruit. Looking at this picture, most people are just going to throw these out when it happens. Black fig fly is established in some counties in Southern California. It is not or has not been present in Northern California until this incident. So these are trees that clearly this retailer brought up from a Southern California grower. Pesticides don't work on this. It's really important to know. It's going out and someone commented on this Facebook post. That's what you get for not spraying. Well, first of all, you don't need to spray fig trees in general. And I'm unaware of any pesticide treatment that would be labeled or would be effective on this particular pest because it's tunneling into the fruit. You would have to spray all the time to kill the adults. And that's simply not practical. In the case of a pest like this that affects a major crop like cherries or citrus, the ag commissioner, the ag department will move very quickly to establish a quarantine. And that'll be, you know, nurseries are the first that know about this. I could tell you if there's a quarantine on this one, and there is not yet. There's not a big fig industry in California. You don't have fig growers jumping up and down, going to the California Department of Food and Agriculture and telling them, please implement a quarantine. If you purchased a fig tree in Sacramento Valley, from anyone really, and they happen to be big enough that they're bringing in stuff from Southern California, the simple thing you could do is go out and pick all the fruit off of that tree right now, put them in a bag, put them in the freezer to kill them, and then put them in the trash. The nursery itself should immediately notify the ag commissioner. My suggestion to this person who posted this, and this is the reason I mentioned this, there is a pest exclusion division at every county agricultural commissioner's office. That's their one of their primary jobs, is monitoring the spread of pests, whether there's a quarantine or not. This was in Sacramento County, so you call the Sacramento County Agricultural Commissioner. There's an individual there who is responsible for this. And yes, obviously contact the retailer. And if they're a reputable retailer, they will either remove all the fruit from the trees right away, or they'll remove the trees or something, but they will hopefully take action to get this particular pest out of their inventory. If you bought a fig from a place that has fruit on it and it came from Southern California, or just look at them, and this is the main thing, just look at them and see, get that fruit off of there, dispose of it. We don't want this pest all over Northern California. It won't surprise me if within the next year or so a quarantine is implemented, but it could be too late by then, because there is lots of north-south interstate intra-state commerce of nursery stock. Big retailers have to buy from growers that are big enough to supply them. I don't have to buy from Southern California because I can get what I need from small Northern California growers. Anyone who's bigger than a nursery like mine has to buy in from big growers, and they are bringing them in from Southern California. My guess is a exclusion quarantine will be implemented, but it may be too late at that point. And we don't want all the figs in Northern California, which is a great place to grow figs, to suddenly be wormy and require all this spraying. Because right now, figs are a zero input tree. You barely even have to water them to get good yields. This would be very frustrating if it occurs. There's been enough publicity about this. Sacramento County Ag Commissioner is aware of it. They will take action locally. But I'm just putting this out there because some of you who are listening may have purchased a big fig tree with fruit on it, because we all know as retailers, if it's got fruit on it, you're likelier to buy it than if it doesn't have fruit on it. So check that. Get rid of the fruit if you can. The tree itself, no problem. The fruit, the fly and its larvae are only on the fruit. It's not hanging out on the leaves or the stem or anything like that. But fruit flies can spread pretty readily, not so much because of their flight. They're not strong flyers. It's people that distribute this particular pest and pests like it.
Well, we end the show each time with a quote or a saying or a joke or something. And today I have a quote from William Kent. And no, I have no idea who William Kent is. But okay. It's one of those famous quote places. Anyway, William Kent says, "Garden as though you will live forever."
Wow. That's kind of heavy.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.